Pseudopod, episode 199, June 18th, 2010. This week's story, Broken Bow, by Daniel I. Russell. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I, by the hoary hosts of Hogoth, apparently, I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from Daniel I. Russell. Daniel's work, like Connor MacLeod, appears in lots of different places, including Malpractice, the Anthology of Bedside Terror, From the Asylum, Dead West, Midnight Echo 3, and Andromeda Spaceways in Flight Magazine 43, where he was the featured author. His novel, Samhain, will be available in summer this year from Voodoo Press, and he is a member of the Australian Horror Writers Association and the associate editor for the Necrotic Tissue print magazine. He lives in Western Australia with his horror poet partner and three children. Your narrator this week is the magnificent Graham Dunlop, so stay off the balcony, turn the news off, and pay attention, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Broken Bow by Daniel I. Russell. Dark clouds always brought Emma the feeling of imminence, pushed ahead by ill winds from approaching disaster. Standing on the balcony, she gripped the railing, looking down at the park across the street. A bullying breeze thrashed through the leaves and branches, lending them a natural violence. No one dared the chill winds, but then, people had other concerns this day. Not that it was true. It couldn't be. She leaned forward and peered straight down. How many floors, she wondered. Would it hurt? Just for that split second. Would it hurt? Screens flickered pastel blue through dark windows. The majority did as they were told, as long as television commanded them to do so. Stay in your homes, said the announcers. Stay in your homes until we work out what the fuck is going on. In the meantime, some commercials. Beyond the houses and apartments, the high-rises close to the Swan River stood like witnesses at a car crash, gathered in silence, watching and waiting. Over the wind, Emma heard the click of the patio door, followed by her son's continuous cries and the monotonous drone of the television. She closed her eyes. Hun? Her fingers gripped the railing, her nails pushing into the metal, threatening to crack. I told you, she said, low and calm. I need to be alone. I can't take listening to it anymore. Inside, Elliot continued to bawl. She wished John would close the door. I've made you a drink, said her husband. It's a little chilly out here, Em. Come inside. She sighed. Please, John, give me a minute. Elliot's cries descended to a choked moan for a second before reaching crescendo with a sharp wail. Em,
please,
she snapped and faced him. John, still in his pale brown pajamas and maroon dressing gown, loitered in the doorway, the edge of the glass door in one hand, and a steaming mug in the other. Beneath his uncombed hair, his eyes burned red. He'd been crying again. Please, hun, he said. I get worried with you standing out here in this wind. Bullshit. She knew what he was afraid of. Come inside. I don't want to come inside. He swallowed. We need to talk about what's happened. Emma turned away, preferring the cold kiss of the wind on her tear-streaked cheeks, the perfect emptiness of the park across the street, the pavement all that way down. Nothing's happening. Everything's fine. She rubbed the goosebumps that had cascaded down her arms. Our son's crying. I'll feed him, but just a few more minutes. Please. John walked into the small kitchen. About to pitch the hot tea across the room, He took a slow breath, tipped the drink down the sink, and delicately placed the mug at the side. Hands covering his eyes, he leaned back against the table. "Why?" he asked. "Why us? What did we do?" Fists squeezed, he rubbed his eyelids, cursing God, cursing the events looped on the news, cursing Emma for burying her head in the sand and pretending everything was fine. Nothing was fine. Not a fucking thing. He stank. He ignored it. It had all begun 3 days ago. Dressing, washing, eating. None of it seemed important anymore. The first thing he'd prepared in that time was the mug of tea, and that was a peace offering. "Get off the damn balcony!" he screamed, and pounded his fists on the tabletop. The wine glasses at the center jumped and clinked. A decision was needed. If Emma took the easy way out, he'd be the one left to make it.
Fuck!
Weeping, he lurched into the lounge, averting his gaze from the bassinet. From within, Elliot's relentless cries blared out, "Two weak lungs, a surprising powerhouse." John collapsed on the sofa, burying his face in a cushion. "And conditions remain unchanged," said the reporter on screen. She stood in an expensive suit outside Royal Perth Hospital. The apocalypse wore Armani. "So to repeat, the government's instructions are to stay inside and not panic. The widespread violence and rioting across the United States and Europe was a knee-jerk reaction to this unexplained phenomena. Thanks to the strict management of our border security, the so far unknown trigger for this event was delayed. The government, and indeed all Australians, have had time to come to terms with this disturbing new development and to prepare themselves." "Prepare," John said, lifting his snotty face from the stifling fabric. "How can you prepare for this?" Elliot replied with a shriek.
"Shut up!"
John screamed.
"Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!"
The Prime Minister, surrounded by thrusting microphones, appeared on screen. As always, a small smile adorned his face, like he knew what the joke was but refused to tell. Of course, he stated safety to Australians was the top priority.
"For the last time, John, I can't stand listening to this."
Emma had come in from the balcony without him noticing. She strode past, her tired gown flowing out behind like a decrepit wedding veil, and snatched the remote from the arm of the sofa. She turned off the television.
"It's all crap," she said. "They can't expect us to believe this crap."
John folded his arms and rested his chin on them, watching her. He didn't bother to argue the point. The last 3 days had been spent arguing the point. Emma threw down the remote and approached the screaming baby. John blinked.
"No," he said, and sat up. "Don't! Don't you dare go near him!"
Emma stared into the bassinet, a dreamy expression spreading on her face.
"He's hungry. He just needs a feed."
"I mean it, Emma. You're not in your right mind. Just stay away from him."
What the hell did he know? Before John had the chance to move from his sorrow on the sofa, Emma reached into the bassinet and scooped her hands underneath their son. She lifted his tiny body out from between the small blankets. He'd weighed just over 2 kilos at birth, a mere fortnight previous. A small baby, he'd struggled to put on any additional weight, and she raised him to her chest with ease. Elliot continued to moan and cry. Friends, family, and the midwife had warned the young couple about the future restless nights. It seemed Elliot never slept, ever. In part, Emma attributed the recent arguments and confusion down to lack of sleep. She pulled down the top of her gown, exposing her right breast, and poked the already distended nipple into his open mouth. Elliot continued to moan around the nub of flesh, mashing the tip with his gums. He stared up at her unblinking.
"I thought we'd discuss this," John spat. "I don't like you doing that."
"Well, if it makes you that uncomfortable," she replied, "go and make him a formula up, although you haven't bothered for the last few days."
He squeezed the cushion between his fists. "What's the point?"
Emma wrinkled her nose and returned to the patio door. She opened it, relishing the breeze that shifted the stink.
"It makes me sick," said John. "How can you expect me to come near you when I know you've been doing that?"
"It's natural," she retorted.
"There's nothing natural about it. It's sick."
He stood from the sofa and, tottering like a drunk, made his way to the back of the apartment, heading for the bedroom.
"That's it, John," she thought. "Run away again."
He paused and glanced back over his shoulder.
"This has gone on for long enough," he hissed. "Tonight, we're sitting down and discussing this."
With that, he slipped into the bedroom, probably to worry himself to sleep. Emma cared little. The man she thought she knew had shown his true colors these last few days. Just like the others in the apartment block, the first sign of mass hysteria and he was there, a sheep among sheep.
"It doesn't matter," she whispered down to Elliot. "Who gives a fuck if the world's ending outside our door? We're in here safe and happy. All three of us."
She gently rocked her son. He cried. John woke from voided dreams. After such a horrific event, even the subconscious wanted to hide. He untangled his legs from the clinging bedsheets and rolled over to face the window. From the low light glowing beneath the blinds, he guessed the day had reached twilight. The second day he'd slept the sunlight away. With a groan, he sat up and swung his feet from the bed. Elliot was crying. John stood up and rubbed his face, the stubble of his cheeks abrading his palms.
"He won't shut up or keep still," he told the empty bedroom. "He should. He has to."
"Something has to be done." He walked through the apartment into the lounge. The bassinet rocked slightly. Elliot's wailing cut through the air. Emma lay on the sofa, snoring softly.
"Good," thought John. "She needs it. It might clear her head a little."
Elliot screeched and John slammed his hands to his head, massaging the temples.
"If I could just get out," he whispered. "Just go for a fucking walk and get out of this fucking apartment."
The television had been left off and he heard nothing from the apartments next door, above and below. Not a single car had driven past the building in 2 days. Only Elliot filled the vacuum. His howling jumped and spiked in a jagged line behind John's eyes. Something has to be done. John swallowed hard and on trembling legs approached the bassinet. He'd assembled it himself a week before Elliot arrived, erecting the metal frame, hanging the clean white cotton around the cradle, hooking a cuddly Elmo over the edge. He stared at the goggle-eyed red freak, tugged him free and dropped him to the floor. In his cocoon of woolen blankets, Elliot stared up at his father.
"Hey, little man," John cooed and reached inside.
Despite the blankets, Elliot's skin was cold and clammy.
"You got hugs for Daddy?"
He hooked a forearm beneath the baby's flat, non-existent bottom and turned to check on Emma. She mumbled something in her sleep.
"Come on, Bubby," he cooed. "Let's take you out so Mummy can get her sleep, eh?"
Elliot's head flopped back, his mouth hanging open. Spit bubbles popped on his chin and bottom lip. He stared up at his father. Treading softly, John retreated to the kitchen. He pulled a clean tea towel from a drawer and laid it out on the worktop. Placing the moaning Elliot on the makeshift baby table, he stepped back, tears stinging his eyes.
"You're my little boy, aren't you? My boy. My son."
He spoke each word slowly, as if tasting them for the first time. Elliot kicked the air and gurgled. John opened another drawer, reached inside, and snatched his hand back.
"I can't do this," he said, weeping.
Elliot glared at him, almost challenging. John stroked the fine hair on his smooth scalp. The baby responded, trying to look up, trying to find the source of sensation. Everything's new and fascinating to a newborn.
I was going to take you fishing," croaked John.
He sniffed.
"When you're old enough, of course. Have a father and son day on the river, just like I did with my dad. I was going to teach you how to ride a bike and how to throw a footy ball."
His hand ventured back into the drawer. Call it luck or sickening misfortune, his fingers touched the smooth wood of his target. Releasing a sob, he again whipped his hand out, disgusted.
"This isn't right," he said and wiped his eyes. "Why us? What did we do?"
A sigh. John clutched the edge of the worktop and forced his words out.
"I love you, Elliot. More than anything."
He leaned over and kissed his son on the forehead, ignoring the stench. Without looking, he plunged his hand back inside the drawer. His fingers gripped the heavy, solid rolling pin. Emma blinked, dragged from her fitful rest by a hard thump from behind her. Yawning, she sat up and looked around the room. The patio door remained closed and the television was off. "What the hell?" her sleep-addled mind struggled.
John? Thump.
She shook her head. Something felt wrong. Something was missing. The silence. There's no crying.
"Elliot,"
she said with a little more urgency. She stood from the sofa and approached the bassinet. Throwing the blankets aside, she stared at the vacant mattress.
"Elliot."
Thump. The sound had come from the kitchen. Her bare feet pounded the carpet as panic gripped her by the throat and squeezed.
"He wouldn't," her mind reasoned. "He said he wouldn't. He said we'd discuss it first. He said we wouldn't, 'cause it can't be true."
She slid to a halt in the kitchen doorway, grabbing the frame. John, his face warped into a grievous wet mask, turned to her, a darkened rolling pin held over his head.
I had to," he wailed. I had to."
Emma screamed and fell, curling up into a ball on the floor. The linoleum caught her tears as she choked with sobs. He watched her on the balcony. The first rays of morning shone between the buildings along the river and glistened on the water. A flock of birds careened past, oblivious to the current situation and enviously free. Emma seemed not to notice. She leaned against the guardrail, peering down. The bassinet stood beside her. John had moved it outside. The damned thing was a reminder, and every time he set eyes on it, he thought of the tiny wrapped bundle inside. He closed his eyes, refusing to let the movie play once more. he had a lifetime to dwell. On the television, the Prime Minister was back, again reassuring the Australian public that there was no danger and that everything would be fine. "Yes," said John and clicked it off with the remote. "Everything's peachy." An unnatural silence descended on the apartment, and for a moment, John missed the constant crying. Emma had called him a murderer. Again, he'd tried to explain, but she just didn't understand. Since they'd found Elliot still and cold 3 days ago, Emma had struggled to understand anything. He sighed and returned his gaze to her. She stood motionless, hypnotized by the pavement below. "Fuck," he said, and closed his eyes. The networks don't lie. The pictures and footage and scientists don't lie. The goddamn Prime Minister doesn't lie. Even after Elliot had started to move and cry again, she still didn't believe. Something had to be done. This was his son. "Forgive me, little man," he said. "Daddy loves you. Always." He checked the balcony. The bassinet stood alone.
Nothing is permanent. Nothing is pretty. And by pretty, I mean certain, definitive, neat, end of line, that kind of thing. Lose a job, the memories of it stay with you for years. Lose a loved one, try decades. Likewise, there's no such thing as a definitive, total, abject victory. Writers don't make it in one single spectacular moment and then retire to their stupid named house in the Bahamas. They make it in increments, one success at a time, one victory at a time. Each one a brick in a wall, which in turn becomes part of a larger structure, which in turn becomes the structure of their life, of their career, of your life, of your career. Or maybe it's just me. Things get in the way. The center, like the man said, rarely holds, but you incorporate that. You work around it. You work under it. You work through it. You do what you have to do. Like Ian Malcolm once put it, life finds a way. Even at the end of the world, life finds a way. You see, it turns out we're imprisoned, not by some supernatural force or people with malicious intent. Well, not just by them. By the way, if you are, the secret is pretend you've eaten the drugged food, then clonk them on the head with the metal tray and run. But also by the cages of meat that we are still trapped in. We still need sleep. We still eat too much. We still bicker. We still love. We still argue. We still try to cope, and we never quite succeed or fail enough. The wheel turns. Sisyphus goes home, eats his TV dinner, and watches telly. Life goes on, even when life everywhere else doesn't. We're a wily, tough species, and that's awful and wonderful all at once. Bill Hicks, I contend, had it wrong, and that after a nuclear war, cockroaches, Keith Richards, and the idea of humanity will survive. An idea that turns and whines and complains and loves and recreates and reinvents itself over and over again. Or to round up my quote trifecta, or possibly quadfecta. Is quadfecta real? Is that a word? It is now. Anyway, albeit in a slightly mangled way, the only thing that will remain of humanity is an idea. And ideas are bulletproof. Pseudopod is powered entirely and solely by your donations. Seriously, we are. We rely on you to do it all. Pay our authors, cover our server costs, heat the castle, the whole thing. And you know what? You always do. You're a very, very generous bunch, and we're extremely grateful. So, if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and continue to be generous by clicking on Feed the Pod. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod wants you to join us next week for episode 200.